So this morning I wanted to talk a bit more about this inner terrain that we are investigating, so that as we go through the day, we can understand more what's going on in our minds and our hearts in this inner terrain. Rather than giving the talk at the end of the day, I thought it might be helpful to you to understand a little bit more. So as the mind and body become quieter, the practice is strengthened through the continuity of bringing attention moment to moment through the mindfulness that we bring to all the experiences that we have. How's the volume? Is it all right? I guess so. What becomes more and more evident as the mind gets quieter are the three very deeply rooted tendencies of the mind: greed, attachment, desire, hatred, the various forms of it, rage, aversion, resistance, and one can go on, and also delusion. Sometimes that's expressed as ignorance, not knowing, or knowing and thinking you know, but it's knowing wrongly. But I'd like to give a little more attention to the greed and attachment part, of course, because we're talking a lot about letting go this weekend. So when we're in this process of opening the mind, opening the heart, this is what we join and participate in a spiritual process for. It not only illuminates what is beautiful, what is blissful, but it also illuminates the experiences that are very hard to open to. It opens to difficulty. If that didn't happen, if we didn't open to the difficult parts of ourselves, there wouldn't be any growth. There wouldn't be any maturing in our spiritual life. We would just kind of hang out. And oftentimes, I know even for myself, there have been times that I've come across some very easeful place in my practice, and attachment can lurk around there too. We want to just hang out where it's always easeful. But as I said, there isn't much deepening. There isn't much growth in that place. And that's why it's important to open to the difficulty of life. So, as Mark Twain says, self-discovery is not always good news. We have to be willing to open to what's difficult. But the good news is that even though it's painful to experience such tenacious attachment, such clinging that and identification that we wonder, how did we ever get to this point? How did we ever make it here in our lives? We see how we get so tenaciously clinging to views and opinions, to attach to certain people, and thinking that in certain ways of identifying with parts of ourselves, we see ourselves as that way all the time. We don't see any room for transformation sometimes. So when the light of mindfulness shines upon those places, the good news is there's no longer any delusion. There's no longer ignorance, at least for moments at a time, and sometimes for many, many moments, for long periods of time. We really see clearly what's going on. And although this is not an easeful time, it's actually a time of great learning. It's a time of great opening. And it's what we really have to remember when we see what's going on in the body and the relationship of the mind to the body. When we see it, we can do something about it. But when we don't see it, we just kind of blindly led along by the old habit patterns of the mind that keep us more running in circles rather than kind of following a trajectory that is onward leading for us. I love this saying by Carl Jung. Enlightenment doesn't mean envisioning bodies of light. It means making the darkness known. So every time we open upon something difficult, if we can remember that we're making the darkness known, we're making the darkness known. This is so important. Sometimes even reflect that to yourself. This light of mindfulness is known as a shining light on whatever is being paid attention to. This light of mindfulness is making the darkness known. Manindra used to always say to me, where even there is a little light, a small little light of a candle, and you bring it into a dark room, we can see much, much more. And how much more if that candle is a very bright light? And it can get that way as we continue to practice. The light of mindfulness gets stronger and stronger. It makes the darkness known in ways that we can feel trusting of the light of mindfulness. We can feel that our energy can reside there rather than be called away and kind of blindly identified with whatever the difficult parts of our being are. So we're bringing this powerful light and the neutrality of mindful attention. Mindfulness doesn't push away what feels difficult to face. It doesn't grab and hold on and get sticky with what's pleasant. It just faces, like with a mirror, clean mirror, it just faces and reflects what is going on in that moment. So the darkness, it said that the darkness and delusion are dispelled during clean and clear moments of mindfulness. So today, talking more deeply about this tenaciously rooted habit of craving, of the desires that lead to suffering, of clinging, of attachment. Now, I just want to make it clear that, of course, you know, there's always this comment, what about desires that are good, like the desire to keep our children and our family safe and protected, and to send, you know, our children to school and to have a pleasant abiding for ourselves. That's all well and good, and we use the word desire for that. This word, or the words that are used in Pali for this clinging, this craving, attachment, desire, are all leading to suffering and not to the end of suffering. Remember that in English that we can have words like desire that also lead to the end of suffering, like the desire to understand ourselves, the desire which helps us to understand others, the desire to open to life as it is, to have a spiritual life. So here we're talking about the desire that leads to suffering, attachment that leads to suffering. So how do we recognize and how do we become vigilant, not negligent, about this state of mind? How can we understand this powerful force in a way that gives us courage to overcome it? If it's not recognized, the force is strengthened through habit. And that's why we have the practice of renunciation. So we see what our habit patterns are, and we don't feed them. Maybe we make resolves or little open-ended goals or aspiration to, when we see something coming up, we don't act on it. Or when we know that it's a certain action or our words or ways of thinking are going into certain directions, we may just actually have a good positive no, not going there now. How many times in your life, probably as many times as in mine, that I've seen the mind go in a certain direction and I've said to myself, I've had to say kind of silently but in a a loud enough silent voice to myself, not going there, not going there. How many of you have done that? Because we know the mind goes in that direction. And when we say that, when we're really, it's a loving voice when we say that to ourselves, it doesn't go there. We feel that another door opens up and we can develop more patience, more kindness, more wisdom with whatever is being opened in front of us, if it's in the environment or inside of us. So if it's not recognized, that force is strengthened through habit, the force of being attached to our views and opinions of how we think it should be for others, for loved ones, and for how we think it should be in our environment or for ourselves. So when we see that happening, we can just say no, you know, not going there, and turn the mind to someplace else, which is what we're learning how to do in our spiritual path. When it's not recognized unknowingly, it controls our lives. And we can see sometimes even when we say, no, not going there, it still goes there. I mean, it may not go there for 5 minutes, and then the other person does their thing that they always do, and we can't help it. You know, we have to go in with the way that we always go in. And, you know, we know time and time again it leads to a certain place. And, you know, how many times do we have to have that lesson before we really pay attention and we really practice restraint and renunciation? It controls our lives, and I think it's important to admit that to ourselves. It's one of our, you know, Buddhist whatever steps there are. There are many steps, you know, there's 3 of that and 7 of that, and there's not just 12, but how many times does it take to actually admit that we've gotten to this dead end over and over again? So let's not let it unknowingly take us there again and again and again. So as I mentioned last night, and it's good to take it in again from the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, craving arises in the negligent, meaning the unmindful. The craving of a person addicted to careless living grows like a creeper, jumping from life to life like a fruit-loving monkey in the forest. In other words, we're just looking for one pleasant experience after another, just avoiding one unpleasant experience after another. So we just kind of running this way and that way because of not paying attention, not really seeing clearly what is controlling our lives, the deep addiction that we have to craving, to clinging, to attachment. So in the Buddha's teaching, these are called the 3 roots of suffering, because when they're not recognized, when we're not mindful of them, we suffer in the moment, and we suffer because of the consequences of following the habit pattern, not really paying attention to what may be some inner voice that is more and more becoming clear to us, becoming louder than the voice of the addiction to whatever causes suffering, the unknowing. That voice of wisdom becomes more clear to us, and we can renounce, we can relinquish, we can practice that letting go. So much hinges on this one root of suffering that it's important to understand its nature. Just as we understand the luminous nature of mind, which is wonderful to understand and experience, but it's just as important to understand the nature of clinging, craving, attachment, how it's relinquished, how the mind can be free of it, what supports it. The Buddha's teachings revolve around the 4 Noble Truths. Basically, I like to call them the facts of life. When we really kind of whittle it down to the basics. What are the facts of life? Most of you know already these Four Noble Truths, but just to put this attachment in the framework of the Four Noble Truths. The first Noble Truth is expressed in Pali as dukkha saccha, dukkha saccha. And sometimes it's kind of misinterpreted in English as life is suffering. Like, what a way to attract people to a spiritual path. I never liked that way of, you know, translating dukkha saccha, life is suffering. Really, when you examine those words, dukkha means suffering. Saccha means the truth, the truth. So we can translate those words as there is the truth of suffering. There is the truth of suffering. And all of us can understand with just a very practical mind that when we kind of bypass that, when we are ignorant of that fact, and we just kind of go for what's easeful, go for what's pleasant, we're really not getting the whole picture. Where, you know, something is wrong with the picture that only wants to recognize that we can hang out in bliss all the time. Because it's not true. We need to know how to traverse this terrain, how to work with it. And the first thing is really recognizing and accepting it. So suffering, in this First Noble Truth, it said that suffering is to be investigated. And this is what the Buddha said, the First Noble Truth is to be investigated, not denied, not ignored. Because this is the very place that ignorance arises, when we ignore this very first fact of life. The Second Noble Truth is that there is a cause, an origin to suffering, which is attachment, craving. And the Buddha says, this cause is to be relinquished, to be abandoned. So first to investigate, and then when it comes up, to notice how it arises. And this is what we're doing in this weekend, understanding really how craving and desire attachment arises, and understanding how it can be let go of. So the Second Noble Truth, there is a cause, an origin of suffering, and this cause is to be relinquished, to be abandoned. The Third Noble Truth is that there is an end to suffering, and this is the good news part. There is an end to craving, to the suffering that comes with craving. It can be possible. It is possible. And so this is to be experienced. This Third Noble Truth. This is something that the Buddha's teaching pointed to over and over again. And the Fourth Noble Truth is that there is a way, there is a path to the end of suffering. And that path is the Eightfold Noble Path, which in most of the teachings of the Dharma that are shared with you through all of your wonderful community Dharma leaders and the teachers that come here, in one way or another, it all connects to the Eightfold Noble Path. And so this path is to be traversed. This path is to be walked on. So the First Noble Truth is the recognition of the human predicament. It's like they use these four facts of life in the time of the Buddha because there was this understanding about recognizing what the disease is. So what is our human predicament? And then the Second Noble Truth has to do with the diagnosis, the cause. Why is there suffering? The reason for it. And this was kind of like the outline that they used during that time. The Third Noble Truth is a prognosis, that it really is possible for the end of suffering, for the end of this disease of suffering, this very deep, ubiquitous disease. It's not so you know, like one particular thing, like acid reflux. It's really very, very deep, the main cause of all of our dis-ease in life. The prognosis is that we can become free, and this is our potential as a human being, just like the Buddha. The Buddha wasn't a god. The Buddha wasn't a celestial being. The Buddha was a human being. When he was asked, you know, are you a god? He said, no. Are you a celestial being, like a deva? Or he said, no. Are you a Brahma, like the Brahma in the Brahma realms and other realms of existence? No. And he was asked, what are you? Who are you? And the Buddha said, I am awake. Awake to how it is in life. Really acknowledging the wholeness, the completeness of it. So the fourth noble truth is the therapy, is the kind of medicine, the methodology enabling us as human beings to realize this potential. So we have to face everything. We have to open our minds and hearts to really understanding the root of this suffering, the root of craving, clinging, attachment. When we understand its nature, not intellectually, I mean, now I'm giving you this Dhamma talk, which is more intellectual in nature, but trying to relate it to our moment-to-moment life. When we understand its nature, how it operates, how it manifests, how it feels in the body, as we were practicing yesterday, what happens when we feel clinging in the body, the tightness, the tension, or the dispersion of the mind, the fracturedness of the mind, how it manipulates us, how it fools us. When we understand its nature, it's not as likely to entrap us when we can understand what's going on. So I'm hoping that I can just cover in a very basic way the different kinds of attachment that are experienced, to review that again briefly. And the mindful, how mindfulness deconditions its forceful nature. How that leads to freedom in the moment. Here in our moment-to-moment practice, we're learning how to actually feel a moment of release, a moment of relief, a moment of easefulness, knowing when it's there and then realizing it's gone. So I want to, as we go through this, I want to reassure you that experiencing attachment, aversion, all the various forms of it, and delusion is very much part of being human. So usually when I give this talk without saying this, or I forget to say it, that's why I wrote it in red this time, people, you know, start feeling that something's wrong with me because I'm feeling attachment or aversion, or that I'm a bad person, and that identification gets so much more reinforced when we hear a talk like this. But try to keep it in the contents of we're learning about how it's like to be human. It's like this for everyone. It's not just, don't take this as it's all about me, you know, and then get identified with that. See if you can see it as this universal understanding about attachment and all its various causes and conditions. So when we understand it more, we come to understand how also the causes and conditions that support its weakening, its lessening in our lives, the causes and conditions that lead to its uprooting for us. So this is very important to see and understand. What can we bring forth in our lives that will help us to weaken it when it's there? For example, as you were saying, the young lady was saying about doing metta practice, it weakens the force of fear, it weakens the force of aversion. And we know that aversion is just the flip side of attachment. It's another way of feeling that gripping in the mind. We learn that we can strengthen the conditions of generosity, of patience, of equanimity, the power of wisdom to see through the illusion of the solid sense of self. And we see this power of wisdom when we see the impermanent nature of one moment of attachment. So we're understanding the inner terrain more clearly, learning to have more acceptance of how it is for ourselves. So recognizing what's going on and then accepting. Because when we're, you know, we recognize a difficult moment and we just can kind of surrender to it. And then that's when the investigation can take place, when we're not fighting it, when we're not resisting it. Most of the time, when some suffering comes up, we just don't want it to be there. There's kind of turning away from it. We don't really want to be with it. So we look for something else. We think about what's going on rather than be with what's going on in our hearts. There's this phrase that Manindra gave me about surrender. And it's not about, you know, being a doormat, but it's more about opening that kind of surrender. And I want to tell you this story, and some of you have heard it maybe many times already, but it's a story that has a good punchline, and it might help you to have a little more surrender to difficult times. It was a time when I was new in practice, and Manindra was staying with us because he was going through some time that he had to recuperate from surgery. And I wanted everything to be perfect for him. So there was some very, very strong attachment to how I thought it should be in our household. Quiet, even though I had teenage children, you know, and having a possibility of eating good food, restfulness, all of that. So everything was going fine, and one day my pre-teen the youngest child, who always gives me permission to tell this story, but of course I have to tell her that I did, and then I, you know, give her some remuneration for it, a pat on the back or a good book to read or something. The last time she got a computer, so that was a really big reward for this. Anyway, she and her very good father, Steve, my husband, is not her father, but my husband was her father. So, anyway, very good father to the children all along the way. He was a very good partner. Went in different directions. Everybody, especially women, get curious about that. Anyway, that's a story. But at this time, they were having the biggest fight that they ever had before that time. And Manindra and I were sitting at the dining room table. So I was sitting here, and Manindra was sitting at that corner there. So they started fighting about something in another room. And they got really, really loud. And I started to hear my daughter, Therese, say, "No!" And her father was saying, "Yes, you will, Therese. Yes, you will." And, "No!" And so she stomped around us and down the hallway into her bedroom. So she went into her bedroom, slammed the door with all her might. And in the meantime, I was like cringing, oh my God. You know, everybody can hear this in the neighborhood, and especially Manindraji. And here I wanted him to have such a peaceful time. And I really had so much, I was really controlling a lot of the situation with the family. Now, please do this, now don't do that, you know, remember Manindraji, etc., etc. And so I was really tight. And so when there was a shouting, slamming the door, the father saying, open this door. No, with all her might. Open this door. In the meantime, I'm slinking and slinking down in my seat and just having, what am I going to do? What am I supposed to do? Having this thing to stand up, you know, and shout myself, stop it. But I was kind of immobilized. So for the last time, the father says, open this door or I'll kick the door down. And my daughter says, go ahead. And it's like, oh my God, you know, shall I go back to being a Catholic in the name of the Father? So, you know, please help. You know, so he does. He kicks the door down. Yeah, and there's a hole in the door. So in fact, he was just over for Christmas the other day and he was retelling me the story. And so I just don't know what to do. And Manindra, I was looking at him, and his face was going, he was looking here and there, you know, like darting his eyes, like what to do, you know. But I didn't see any kind of judgment. Of course, I don't really know what's going on in his mind. He leans over towards me, from this way towards me. He puts his right hand on my left forearm, and he says to me, with all the compassion in the world, he says, surrender to the law. The law meaning, this is how it is, Kamala. You can't fight it. Accept it. And just that, I always remember, you know, the feeling of his hand on my forearm and that feeling that I had that he's accepting it. Just going to accept how it is. So surrender to the law. You know, how it is in the moment, that moment of suffering, that moment of such rigid attachment to how I think it should be, that there shouldn't be any pain in the heart, in the body. But this is how it is. The first noble truth. Can we accept it? This is what our practice is asking us over and over and over again. It's shouting to us with the pain in the body and the pain in the heart and the pain in our lives. Can we just accept how it is? Equanimity. Equanimity. This is one of the supports of our practice. Equanimity says, this is how it is right now. So he didn't go about, you know, giving me a lecture afterwards that you should have done this, you should have done that. He just really, his whole energy was about helping me to accept how it is. That's what he was all about, not just then, but a lot. Of course, you know, then I got up and I could go over to the father and the daughter, understanding that, you know, this is how it is for me and this is how it is for them. They have their stuff. I mean, they really do have a good relationship. But they have their stuff, and they have their karmic conditions to work out, which is way beyond me. Yeah, I can help, I can do what I can, but their karmic river is running strongly. I can put in what I can put into that, but I can't control it. And that's what the lesson is during those moments. So I could go over there and say, look, can we just settle down for a little bit now? And maybe, you know, that kind of can help. And maybe it did, and it did. But they continued to have their thing going on, but they do have a beautiful mutual respect for each other. So we have these places of us that think things should be in a certain way. I should be healing in a certain time frame. Or, you know, my family should be in this perfected way. But it's not that way. It's the first noble truth to come back to over and over again. Dukkha Saccha. I like to say it in that way. Dukkha Saccha. There is the truth of suffering. It can't be denied. And denial only causes more suffering. So once I asked Manindraji, you know, what do you think, where do you think in me that I could use more attention, more kind of work? And many of you may know that in Buddhist circles there is this understanding called the personality types. How many of you know about that, the three personality types in Buddhist understanding? You may know or have heard Sharon give that talk. She's the one who's got that talk on the personality types down. So the three personality types are the greedy type, the aversive type, and the deluded type. And so it's wonderful in our Buddhist circles that we just say, you know, like, hi, I'm Kamala, and I'm the greedy type. And that's, you know, we just kind of cop to that. And it's really like surrendering to that's what comes up most in this mind. And the attachment to whatever. And one time when I asked Manindra, what type am I? And he said, you're very balanced. You have all three. And I do notice that I do, you know. I'm noticing more and more the other ways of being. But mostly what comes out is like wanting it to be in a certain way. I'm looking at pleasant conditions and wanting the mind to go there more than anything else. So all of us have a combination of all of them, but one gets most predominant. And in deep retreats like this, or, you know, times when you're in a longer retreat, you really get to see what the default setting is more clearly. So remember that this is good news. It's said that, you know, there is kind of like an opposite to these personality types. The opposite of the greedy type nature is the faithful type. Now, I just want to give the example in this one area of greed, attachment, because this is what we're talking about mostly this weekend. The greedy type and the faithful type have one thing in common, and that is seeking, going after something, turning the mind or attention to seeking something out. It can manifest like the energy of desire. So talking about the seeking out and desire, in the personality with a greedy temperament, which is always accompanied by delusion, even aversion, always accompanied by delusion, there is a seeking out of sensual pleasures as an object. So that's very straightforward in the seeking out sensual delights and sensual pleasant experiences in hearing, in tasting, in smelling, in feeling something in the body, feeling pleasant feelings in the body, you know, in thoughts. When if there were a screen behind my mind, you would see that the mind is, but there's more attention to it, of course. The mind is going after, I could have this for lunch. That would be nice. Maybe that brownie is going to be out again. So that's where it goes. It doesn't go to aversive type thoughts. A little more now than before, but because the mind is seeing more things more clearly. But that's what it seeks out. Pleasant feelings derived from taste, smells, etc. The six sense doors. When it's unconsciously done, it just goes there blindly in a habitual way. Not able to really discern what leads to happiness, what leads to suffering. It just habitually goes there with not very much mindfulness. So this kind of seeking out can lead to harm, can lead to suffering when we're not aware of it. It's said that greed does not give up what's harmful. I mean, even when we see something that's harmful and we keep going after it, when we want it so strongly, we can't say no. There's a deep addiction to it. Now the faithful temperament, when it's fully developed, it's accompanied by wisdom. not delusion. And all of us have part of this faithful temperament because we're here. We're seeking out ways to be free from suffering. We're seeking out spiritual friendship. We're seeking out hearing the Dharma. So seeking out has the energy of seeking out special qualities of virtue, it says. Seeking out ways of helping for the benefit of all beings. Seeking out the cultivation of generosity. Seeking out opportunities to let go. Seeking out good friends, hearing and practicing the Dharma. Seeking out things that inspire more faith. Having aspirations, not desires, but in another way of saying it, aspirations to be free from suffering. To practice this aspiration, to practice in a certain way, to practice loving kindness, generosity. This is how aspiration is different from desire. So we can see that this seeking out is something that these two have in common. And a lot of times in our spiritual practice, we think a desire is really a desire to be free. Oh, this is really bad. But it's really the seeking out of faith. So kind of put it in that category. As we go through this process of transformation, we learn that more and more clearly. So we kind of see the inner terrain in a clearer way. We see the proclivities and the tendencies of mind that are unconscious, and we become conscious to them, and we see the proclivities that we're really conscious of and feed because we know that they're good. They end up to be onward leading. But even though we've practiced a long time, even in my own practice, I see there's still greed. There's still unconscious greed. There's still aversion. It's lessened. There's more uprooting of it in my practice, but it still shows up. Now, we can tell usually when those around us are of the sensual type. You notice I've even changed the word from greed to sensual. The sensual type, seeking out delights, sensual delights. We can tell that type different from the aversive type. The aversive tendency is a very sharp mind, and that's what Steve, many of you know my husband Steve Armstrong. He has a very, very sharp mind, very, very quick. He's so quick sometimes that I can't get a word in edgewise. It's really nice to teach by myself sometimes. So he's so quick and very intelligent, and he can see the tendency for the mind to go in a certain direction. And, you know, he's very alert. So that's kind of like the opposite of aversion, but it's still kind of, the aversive mind is seeking out clarity. And it's responding with clarity, reacting with clarity a lot. So my standard example about this, and I'd like to give examples that kind of relate to everyday life, and sort of when I tell a story, your eyes open up. And so we go into a restaurant, and right away I see the place where I want to sit. Maybe their flowers are prettier on that table, or they call out to me, or it's not windy in that area, or maybe the air conditioner is not there. And maybe it's more quiet and it's more beautiful. It calls to me. And so right away, I'll speak up and I'll say, I want to go there. I want to go sit there. And usually Steve will follow my lead because he knows, yeah, that's a good place. But he'll see something else. And sometimes it's through aversion and sometimes it's through sharpness of mind. And he says, I don't want to go there. Well, why? Well, the air conditioner is there. It'll be right at my back or at your back. Well, okay. Well, I don't want to go there another time. Well, why? Because I want to get out really quick. We've got to get to this Dharma talk, and I want to get to the door really quick. Well, okay, you know, but sometimes I see it, or I might perceive it, even though he isn't saying it that way, as aversion. And he'll see, well, there's Kamala's wanting mind again. Well, okay, you know. Well, we show up in life this way. Of course, the way that a deluded mind will say, and sometimes I get in that mode, delusion, I'll say, I don't care. I'll go where everybody decides to go. You know, we just kind of follow like sheep in a way. I'll just follow what you all do, because the mind is kind of lazy, doesn't want to make a decision. It's quite relieving to know what manifests as one's own personality or as our partner's personality, because it's really easy for me to say with understanding, not always with compassion, but I can say, oh, there's aversion again. When Steve is coming out with a certain blah, blah, blah. But I'm not saying, there you are again, being aversive. It's in a certain way, I understand, there's aversion, the impersonal experience of aversion, that the impersonal event of aversion. It's not pinned on him. You see the difference? So when we know it for someone else, it doesn't get pinned on them as they are an aversive person. They're being identified by me as an aversive person. Even Sayadaws, even Burmese teachers, they say that, and Achans, you know, the ones I'm most connected to from Thailand, from Burma, they still have their personality. Some are kind of come out as more like Upanditas, very like, he says it like it is. And he says, you have to take it in the way I'm putting out just a fact. Just whatever, however you react to it, take a look at that. And so he just puts it out very straightforward. And he can seem aversive. Sometimes I think he is. It's kind of that compassion with the sword. And so he has a kind of personality, very strict. And then there are very loving and kind Sayadaws and Achans that have a nature that exudes loving kindness. Just you can see it in their face when they walk in the room. So they say in Burma, you know, even if these people are arahants, fully enlightened beings, they have this saying that even when the bottle's empty, there's still a smell. Get it? Yeah. There's still the personality there. So, I mean, that's okay. That's how it is. So there's different words that characterize the varying intensities that we call desire or attachment. The English language doesn't suffice. You know, just like we always have this question about desire, and there's some good desires, etc. Well, that's why we have to talk about the Pali words. And I talked about them last night a little bit. And just a little review. I started with the word raga. It's one of the words in the descriptions of this whole terrain, which means lust. But it's not just physical lust. It's coming from a state of lack, that we need something to make us complete, or to make the moment complete. We need it so badly that it's an addiction more than anything else. It is always seeking fulfillment, this drive, this lust, this raga. But its drive is inherently insatiable. It's this insatiable wanting and desire. As long as it endures, it maintains a sense of lack. It's like sometimes in the descriptions of this in the text, it's like they call this a hungry ghost realm. It's depicted as a ghost with a very huge belly and a tiny pinhole mouth. It's like you just have to keep feeding it all the time. It reminds me of a Dhamma talk that I heard by Sharon Salzberg on desire. She was somewhere in the Middle East, I think, And someone, one of the hawkers in one of the markets shouted out, "I have what you need." I have what you need. And that's what the mind of lust is tuned into. I have what you need. I have what you need. And what goes where we go right away, maybe we're not so conscious of it, but where we go right away, the inner terrain is like, yes, I need it. I need something. Maybe that will do. But we don't see the place of neediness that we go to. There are needs that we need to be conscious of and that we actually need for our survival, of course. Love and connection, all of that. But there are needs that we don't, that are really causing more suffering. This constant need to fulfill that empty hole. So it struck me to really be conscious of that state of need, not just the desire, but this is part of opening the terrain of the mind and seeing, putting more light there and seeing when is that there, and to investigate it, that deep state of constant need, neediness, constant walking, wanting. When we look at it, this is the human predicament. This is what keeps us on the wheel of samsara, of constant becoming through these this feeling of emptiness that we need to fill up all the time. Seeking happiness by feeding the wanting over and over again. So now I have this mantra to myself when I feel that need that coming up, that kind of emptiness that I have to fill all the time. And it goes, I have what I need. I have what I need. When I see something that the mind is attracted to or hear something and I say, oh, I want to buy that CD or I want to own that particular piece of furniture or clothing, and I realize I have what I need. I really do. I have what I need. So just turning the mind, noticing that, and then turning the mind someplace else. So as a way to counteract that habitual, unwise feeling, attachment to that feeling. So the other word is tanha, that constant thirst where we feel thirsty. So it's like taking that in, going after it, taking it in. And it's like drinking salt water. We only want more. And we go forward and we actually fulfill that wanting and that need. But what does that do? All it does is it feeds that habit pattern over and over again. So tanha means actually feeding that habit pattern unconsciously. And so over and over again, that habit pattern comes up because we're fueling it over and over and over again. So there's this craving, this tanha, for the sense objects, but it's also craving for existence. It says craving for existence, craving for non-existence. So what does that mean? So craving for existence. Did you have planning mind this morning? Planning for the future. I mean, we don't plan for the past. Planning for the future. Craving, that is fueled by craving for more and more existence. And as somebody said yesterday, we don't usually crave for something that causes suffering, to ourselves at least, but we crave for something that is going to feed us somehow in the future. So planning mind is one way that craving for existence happens. What about craving for non-existence? So when that pain came up in the body, or that emotion came up in the heart, or that thought came up, that pattern came up about how it is in our lives somehow, didn't you wish that to end when you became conscious of it? you wanted it to end. And sometimes we want to end ourselves. We don't want this to happen anymore. We don't want this identification with how it is. We don't want me or mine to go on in this way as it has been going on. So it's very simple how we see those things in life. Whenever I'm practicing, especially when I'm practicing in Asia and the weather is hot and it's difficult and I'm having a lot of difficulty in the body, I want it to end. I don't want to go on anymore. And then I have pleasant thoughts and I want to go after that. I want to go after that so I can keep those pleasant thoughts going. Craving for non-existence, craving for existence. So the ignorance of all this fosters the growth of craving because we feed it over and over again. So it becomes habitual in our nature. Wrongly believing that by gratifying craving, it will come to an end. And there's a story about Manindra. He was addicted to sweet things. And one day he said, enough. So he decided, he was in Calcutta, and he decided to go to the sweet shop and buy all the sweets he could on a tray about this, as big as this thing that's holding my papers. And so he put all the things on the tray and he carried it out to somewhere nearby. And he sat down, he said, and he looked at all the things on the tray and he said, you have caused me so much problem in my life. And because of you, but mainly he was talking about, you know, the wanting. You have fed me so often, and the mind has liked eating you all this time. So now I will eat you for the last time. And so he said, he ate everything on that plate. So I'm not suggesting that you do this, actually. But he really ate it all mindfully. And he saw how much it wasn't pleasant all the time. But he was thinking that the next bite would be pleasant. So you know how we like something and we take another bite because we think this will be better? Or maybe like it was before? And so he just kept going for it and going for it and really being mindful of what, after a while, you know, we think it's sweet, but it's really slushy and gooey. You know, it's not really the way we think it is. Eating mindfully brings a lot of wisdom to the mind. So it was one way he got over all of that. And now, you know, I remember he passed away a few years ago, but I remember I would bring, would you, Manindraji, would you like some dessert? And his mouth would have a certain way of going down, and he would go, no. I wish I could do that. So this world we live in is constantly seducing our senses. This is what we're trying to be aware of more and more. So, pleasant feeling, a strong condition for craving to arise. So watching out for that, what the feeling tone is, you know, during a pleasant experience. So not just paying attention to the object of the craving. For example, eating chocolate or having a cup of coffee. It's not just about the contact or the object. It's about the pleasant feeling. It really goes down to that. So notice when you are experiencing something that you're taking in, hearing something, smelling something, tasting something, feeling something. Turn your mind to the pleasant feeling of it. And then experience that, knowing that, noting it. And then turn your mind to how it is passing away. How it is changing. It's just kind of a little turning of the mind to see that. When we see the arising and passing away of pleasant feeling, there's nothing to hang on to. That what comes there is some wisdom. And attachment, if there is any attachment that's lurking nearby, it doesn't coagulate as much. So paying attention to pleasant feeling. Also, you can pay attention to how agitating it is in the mind to want something. So again, turn your attention away from the object of that's being wanted. And say, for example, you want to go outside, and you need to be outside. You want to go outside. Don't go outside. Just pay attention to the wanting to go outside. Stay with it for 3 minutes. Just stay inside the door or sit down and pay attention to how wanting feels. It's very agitating. So turn your mind away from what you're wanting and turn it to the agitation of the wanting mind. Notice the impermanent nature of that. And just kind of knowing it's suffering turns your mind to one of the three understandings of life, the dukkha nature of it. Even wanting, there's suffering in that wanting. The agitation, you can feel it. So these are ways that you can understand how to pay attention to it, because when you bring mindfulness to the experience, in that moment of bringing mindfulness to the experience of pleasant feeling, to the agitation of the wanting mind, mindfulness weakens its force. And you can really feel the mind more settling into the mindfulness, to the awareness of it, rather than being taken by and kind of imprisoned by the wanting itself or the object of wanting. It weakens its force, and in that moment of being mindful of it, it starts to break the pattern. It's like a circuit breaker. It starts to break the pattern of it happening in our lives. Every time we bring mindful attention to the wanting mind, any way it manifests, it starts to weaken its force. So really know that that's the good news of it. Years ago, I gave up chocolate on a whim, and I said I was going to do it for a year. And these are the places that I paid attention to, the mind that wanted to go to, and feeling the agitation in the mind. And then just thinking about the chocolate, just having that pleasant feeling in the mind that reinforced the going forth towards it, paying attention to that. It really gave me such a better view of agitation, of the wanting, of the pleasant feeling that came even just around thinking of it. So turning away from the object and experiencing the feeling around it. So this is what the Buddha said around that. Very explicit instructions. When whatever feeling arises, whether pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, abide contemplating impermanence in those feelings. Contemplate fading away. Contemplate cessation of those feelings. Contemplate relinquishment, letting go. Contemplating thus, we do not cling to anything in the world. When we do not cling, there is no agitation. When not agitated, we personally attain nibbana, the end of suffering. So that's the terrain, and those are the ways of kind of touching into the terrain, really understanding it clearly for ourselves. Later on in the day, I want to talk about some of the antidotes: generosity, loving-kindness, contentment, gratitude, appreciation, renunciation that we've practiced already. And being able to really say from a very spontaneous part of ourselves, I have what I need. So let's sit for a moment and let the words dissolve.